Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
To our new listeners, welcome. To our old listeners, welcome back. Another episode of Magical Education awaits you, but first, we would like to say a few words.
Nitwit, blubber, oddment, tweak. Podcast 9¾ topic of the week is Australian Magical Land.
Hello listeners, I'm Rhea.
And hi listeners, I'm Jem. Before we begin today, I'd like to acknowledge the traditional custodians of country and their continuing connections to land, waters and community. I pay my respects to elders past, present and emerging, and extend that respect to any Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples who are listening. Sovereignty was never ceded. Australian magical land, guys! Who's excited?
I am so excited. We've got so many thoughts. Do we need to explain what acknowledgement of country was? What you just said there, the acknowledgement of country. Do we need to explain that?
Maybe a little bit.
Or was it fairly self-evident?
For anyone who's not Australian or not versed in what acknowledgement of country is, in Australia, we are standing on stolen land. There are plenty of lands and nations that are in this country that we call Australia. And so what often happens is for a significant event or ceremony or something that is significant for the land that you're standing on, if you're introducing that event, what may happen is if a person who, of First Nations descent is there and does a greeting, they might open with a welcome to country. If you're not a person who is First Nations person, then you would do an acknowledgement of country, which is sort of just like paying respect to the land that you're standing on, the people that belong to that land, and just sort of, yeah, does that make sense? Like, it's sort of an acknowledgement.
Yeah, it does.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's something that we haven't done on the show before because it didn't seem relevant to the topics at hand, but because we're now talking about magical Australia and the land and the history and the culture that we're a part of, it seemed like a good idea to open with that.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I as I was listening to you, I'm like, this will make absolutely no sense to any listener who is not Australian and not familiar with our culture and customs.
Well, time to learn.
Yeah. Welcome to the deep end, motherfuckers. Get in.
I think just quickly before we start as well, Australia is a very messy country with a complex history. I think we should start every episode with a bit of a content warning, because although we're trying to talk about different topics, there may be a bit of overlap, and some of the topics that we do talk about may be very triggering. So just to cover off a couple of dot points, we might talk about colonialism, we might talk about genocide, we might talk about the very dark history of this country. So if that's something that you're not comfortable hearing about, I just recommend not listening, especially for the first two episodes. Maybe skip to the later episodes in this miniseries, and we'll talk about the miniseries now.
I would say especially to episode two, which is going to be our history episode, where we will be looking at the history of Australia and talking about that. We'll get to that more. This is going to be more about like the geography and the environment, and we will touch on those topics as they come up, but you should be okay for this one, but be safe for further episodes in the series.
I have a bit of a spiel about our Magical Australia series, if you want me to say that.
Yeah, I think that's a good idea.
Okay, so this is the first episode of our Magical Australia series, where we explore what the country of Australia would be like within the context of the magical world of Harry Potter. In this mini-series, we will cover four broad topics: Australian magical land, Australian magical history, Australian magical culture, and lastly, an Australian magical school. Obviously, all of these topics contain a lot of crossover, but we'll try to remain as on topic as possible and eventually cover all of the overlap by the end of the miniseries.
Okay, so I've approached this sort of trying to keep in mind that I imagine many of our listeners, your only real context for Australia beyond the facts that we've shared in this podcast as we've been running for like 6 years and talking about our own experiences and memories of living in this country. Probably your only real context for Australia is going to be popular culture. So what, like Finding Nemo, Crocodile Dundee, that one Simpsons episode.
And recently, more recently, Heartbreak High. But Heartbreak High, if anything, has shown us that plenty of people don't know a lot about this country.
Yeah.
Because there's been a lot of commentary around some of the themes in that, that people just, it's going straight over their head. They don't get it.
Mm-hmm.
So.
So I, going into Australian land, I started with like some really basic stuff and I thought it would be good to just sort of talk about Australia and then get into the magical Australia stuff. So can I maybe get us started?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Let's go. Let's go geography facts.
Geography facts. Here's what I had about Australian geography. Australia. Starting so basic, guys. We're in the Southern Hemisphere.
Great Southern Land.
Great Southern Land. Which immediately means that we're separated from the majority of the world, both in terms of like physical distance. We're really far away from everything. And the fact that our seasons are reversed. So we have summer during everyone's winter and all of our years and holidays are all jumbled up compared to everyone else.
Mm. By everyone, we're talking about the Western Hemisphere, which is mostly what Australia relates to culturally.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why we can feel like a bit of an outcast in terms of the Western Hemisphere, because that's our culture.
And also, as it's relevant here, the UK and Britain. Everything where Harry Potter is set, we are like as far away from there as you could physically get and still be on the same planet. we are between the Indian and Pacific Oceans as well.
Slay.
Yeah. Australia is the only continent that is also a country. So the entire continent is one country. There's nowhere else on Earth that's that.
There's no one doing it like
no
us.
No one doing it like us. It's the smallest continent, the sixth largest country, and the largest island nation. So what that means is we have no land borders. The entire island is one country and all of our borders are ocean borders.
Yeah. We also have some other islands around us, including Tasmania.
We do. Yeah, I'm going to get to
that. Which are part of Australia.
Yeah. So, yeah. The only other island nation that's close to ours in size is Greenland, which is one quarter the size of us. We're huge.
Yeah. It's pretty big.
Yeah. So Australia, when I'm talking about the country, that's the mainland, which I imagine most of you could probably picture. Tasmania, which is the large island state to the southeast of the mainland. And then several smaller islands on and around our coastline, like Kangaroo Island and Christmas Island. They're all part of Australia as well.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Okay.
Yes, Kangaroo Island is a real place.
Yes, Kangaroo Island is a real place. I deliberately picked islands with the stupidest names because I thought people would find that amusing. Yeah, we've got Christmas Island, Kangaroo Island.
Yeah.
So that's what I have for our geography. Like, I've got some other notable geographic features. We've got Lake Eyre and Uluru and things like that. But I think they'll come up if they come up. We don't need to go on through all that.
Yeah, yeah.
Next, I've got a section on environment and population. Do you want to comment on geography first or move through a lot of this basic note stuff and then start talking about it?
I think just a quick thing on geography. Even though our land mass is so massive, we only have 7 states.
Mm-hmm.
Well, sorry. How many states and territories?
I think it's there's like 5 states, 2 territories.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah. 5 states, 2 territories. So, yeah, the land is basically chopped up kind of like a jigsaw puzzle, but like a child did it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just like lots of... Like, some of the states are just massive. Like, Western Australia is the biggest state, and it's, like, basically half the country.
Yeah, it's a third. It's a full third of the country is one state called Western Australia. Yeah. And it's just the entire West.
Yeah.
The West third of the country is just one state. And it's got, like, 2 people living there.
The majority of the Australian population is situated... Oh, we'll talk about population now. Yeah, sorry.
Yeah, I've got environment and population next.
Yeah.
So, if you've never looked at a satellite image of Australia, I recommend it. There's a reason why our country is called the Red Center, and it's because if you look at us from space, the entire country is just red with like a green border around the edge.
Yeah.
And that's because the vast majority of our landscape is just like flat desert plain or like outback bush.
Yeah.
A full fifth of the country is desert. And even more than that is not technically desert, but has a desert climate, which means it's just desert. It's all just red sand and no people, or very few people out there. So most of the people live around the edges of the country on or near the coastline.
Yeah.
That's where all of our capital cities are, with one exception, which I'll talk about later because it's very relevant.
Special capital city.
One special different city that was put there on purpose for a very specific reason, but everyone else decided to live on the coast where it's habitable.
Yeah.
And our 3 largest capital cities, our biggest populations, are Brisbane, Sydney, and Melbourne. They are all on the east coast.
Yeah.
Along with the majority of the population of the country, everyone lives on the east coast or in the south.
Basically, everyone lives on the east coast, yeah.
Yeah. And the reason for that, there is a very important and very significant reason for that, is our biggest, or maybe not biggest, our most important geographical feature, I would say, is a mountain range which runs along the eastern coast from the north of the country to the south of the country. It's called the Great Dividing Range.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Because it very literally divides the country, not in half, but it divides us like into 10% and 90%.
Yeah.
And what happens is, so rain comes into Australia from the Pacific Ocean. So it clouds blow in from the east to the west.
Mm-hmm.
And so they sweep over the eastern coast until they hit that mountain range, the Great Dividing Range, and that's where they dump all the rain.
Yeah.
So the east coast gets a lot of water and the environment there is very lush. It's very tropical, very prone to flooding.
Yeah.
And then the clouds sweep over the top of the Great Dividing Range and there's no water left for the other side of the country. The land to the west gets less and less water. And we go through like farmlands, then bushland, then out back, then desert, and then it's just desert, desert, desert all the way to the west coast.
And then beautiful Perth with its nice, nice beaches.
In West which Australia. Is it's all the way on the other side, on the coast again.
Yeah, it's in a different time zone.
Yeah. Oh, complete. It's like 3 hours different from the rest of the country.
Yeah.
Like huge. So that one mountain range catches all the rain and it literally divides the country into rainforest and desert.
Yeah.
And that has a massive impact on our population spread. We all cling to the east coast and then the rest of the country is empty by comparison.
Mm. I think another reason why the east coast is obviously more populated is because that is where Australia was colonized. The yes, beginnings of colonization started on the east coast, tried to get over mm-hmm. the Great Dividing Range, but it was pretty unsuccessful for the most part. So
yeah, we'll talk about that probably more in history, but yeah, all of our, the first fleet and Captain Cook, when he originally discovered Australia, that was all along the east coast and that's where everyone settled, Botany Bay, the original colony.
Yeah, so that's why most of the major cities are there, because they've just been built for about 200 years or so.
Mm-hmm. There was actually a theory for a very long time that Australia had an inland ocean.
Yeah.
They thought if they could get across the mountain and get far enough into the desert, they would find like a beautiful oasis that would be populable.
Boy,
and
they were wrong.
They all fucking died. They all died trying to cross the desert. There's nothing there, man. You can just keep going forever.
Well, to be fair, back in like prehistoric times, like I'm talking like Gondwana land, right? When Australia was connected to Antarctica and stuff, like before Pangaea and all that. There was a big ocean there in the middle of Australia because we keep finding fossils that are like from corals and stuff like in the middle of the desert.
Yeah, so. But if you're rewinding back that far, like eventually the whole world was ocean.
Yeah, you're right.
Yeah. Not in like the 17 and 1800s, there was no ocean there.
No.
It was just sand. Like Mad Max said, you can drive until you run out of petrol. You're not going to find anything more but salt. So some natural hazards we've got, cyclones along the northern coast. Darwin is a major city there. They often get hit by cyclones.
Mm-hmm.
Storms and floods along the east. It gets wet there where all the rain is. And then for the rest of the country, drought, heat waves and bushfires are our big, big problems.
Yep.
Bushfires are a massive thing here.
Mm.
So I just wanted to run through just some basic population stats while we're on this sort of topic.
Sure, yeah, yeah.
So comparing to the UK... Population of UK is 67 million. Population of Australia is 25 million. Australia is 32 times bigger than the UK. So we have one third of the population of the UK in 30 times the space.
Yeah.
Australia is a huge, empty country.
Yeah.
Okay. I've got a little bit on climate, and then from there I go into flora and fauna. And I think we can talk about other stuff before we start getting into animals and plants.
Yeah, okay.
But I'll just make a quick note on climate. Our climate, I would say, is extremely level compared to the rest of the world.
Yeah.
We don't have four distinct seasons here. We have two. It is summer from December to February. Autumn and spring are just pre and post summer.
Yeah.
And then winter in the middle of the year is just wet. It's just wet and slightly cold.
That's especially common for everything from about Sydney up, which is like... the northern part of Australia. Down here in Canberra and Melbourne, there's definitely four seasons. Like, I can see them happening before my eyes. But even then, they're definitely not to the extremes that we see in places like UK, America. Like, we don't get snow on our streets. Mm-hmm. If you drive up all the way up to the mountains, you'll see snow. Like, thick snow. But it's not happening. Like, we don't have a city that's built to accommodate snow here in Australia. It's just not existent. Yeah.
I can count on one hand how many times I've seen snow, not in mountains, because there's always snow in mountains. But, like, the number of times I've been, like, walking down the street or something and seen snow fall, I can count on one hand and I would have three fingers left over.
I've never seen that in this country. I've seen it overseas, but not here.
Yeah. Yeah, I've seen it distinctly twice, and I can remember both times. It was both just crazy freak weather. We got, like, 5 minutes of snow, and then it immediately melted.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, temperature ranges obviously vary across the country, but just to give a rough idea, I would say that in winter, we get maybe from 0 to 10 at night, and then 10 to 20 in the day. That's degrees Celsius.
Mm-hmm.
And then in summer, it sits in the 30s, getting up to like early 40s all day and all night. It's pretty much standard.
Yeah,
it's and that's gross. Like, yeah, I would say that's pretty steady across the country. It gets colder in the south, hotter in the north. Like, we know how the equator works.
Yeah,
but pretty standard.
Yeah,
and that's pretty much what you need to know about Australia geography and environment. We'll get into flora and fauna as we talk more about this.
That's been quick geography facts with Rhea. That was fun.
Yeah. Well, like I said, I wanted to talk about the country as if people don't know anything about it. Never heard of it, never been there.
Yeah.
I don't know this country.
I don't know her.
Yeah, who is she?
Let's talk a bit about magic. I think it's important when we're talking about this land topic to, as much as possible, try and think about the physical space, like, and where things are situated on Australia, if we've got, like, a mental map in our mind.
Mm-hmm.
So I had a question here. What does magic feel like in Australia? So I have a bit more on that. We have before made the argument that magic leaves traces, that over time it can have such an impression on an environment that it almost gives that space a personality. How would the oldest and longest surviving civilization living on and interacting with the landscape in Australia affect this environment magically? And by oldest civilization, I'm referring, of course, to the First Nations people of Australia. For anyone who doesn't know, they are the oldest continuing civilization in history.
Mm-hmm.
So they've been here since... I should have Googled that. How long have the First Nations...
I think it's something like 80 million years or 80,000.
Yeah, let me
just surely can't be 80 million. That would be crazy.
60,000 years or more, upwards of 60,000 years is what current research is saying, but I have seen things in the millions.
Okay.
Because they're finding new stuff every day. They're finding new fossils, new cave paintings, new art that predates that, so.
Yeah. So,
yeah.
What we mean by that is in terms of, like, a people and a culture that still exists today, because the Indigenous Australians are still around and still have... We'll get more into Indigenous Australia, but Indigenous Australian culture as, like, a continuous surviving thing, you can trace it all the way from the beginning to now and it still exists and they're still alive.
Mm-hmm.
We are the oldest one in the entire world. And sorry, when I say we, I mean the Indigenous Australians are the oldest one in the entire world.
Yeah.
There are older cultures, but they've died out and disappeared. Not Indigenous Australians. Been around for at least 60 million years.
Yeah.
So... talking about magic leaving traces, when I think about that in terms of the Harry Potter series, obviously the biggest thing that stands out to me is Hogwarts and the fact that the castle is alive because it's been around for about 1,000 years and has been full of magical people that entire time.
Mm-hmm.
And probably when I think in terms of the series, I think, well, some of the most magical places are the places where populations of people are congregating or have congregated for centuries or more and like created these magical spaces. In terms of Australia being a very old country, Australia was discovered and colonised by white people, is it 2 or 3 centuries ago? I should know this off the top of my head.
1778, right?
1778. Oh, God. Yeah. Now you're making me do math. So what, like 250 years ago?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Give or take.
So in terms of, like, I would say the modern population of Australia... like, all of these, all of our big cities that I just mentioned, they've only been around for a couple of centuries at most. Like, we don't have old places, except what's there naturally in the land, because... Oh, we're getting more into history now. Unless I'm very misinformed, which I might be, our Indigenous population didn't have, like, settlements and, like, towns and cities and things like that. Not like, say, like, Aztec people
that, is a that bit... built...
pyramids or anything.
That is a bit of a misinformation.
Yeah, I was under the impression they were more of a nomadic people and moved from place to place within their own territories and lands.
So, no. Okay. Basically, there were structures, there was agriculture, there was diplomacy, there was civilization in every sense of the world, in every sense of the word. Given the nature of this landscape, it mightn't have looked how a Western person might expect it, but it was there. Like, there was villages, people were building structures, there was people tilling the land, fishing and stuff like that. There was agriculture and aquaculture. Like, important locations and cultural sites were sort of, were fashioned by the First Nations people of this land, but they were still natural, if that makes sense. Like,
yes, that's what I was leading into.
Yeah. They were taken care of. They were purposefully shaped. That it, yeah, it, that, like, there was a purposeful shape of the land by Indigenous people. There was also the nomadic aspect of it. It depends on the different, what nation you were in. So, as we talk about this, I'm just being very aware that we haven't done the spiel yet. We are not Indigenous Australian people. We are not First Nations people. We are white Australians colonizing this land, essentially. Second generation immigrants.
Yeah, second generation immigrants with British and Irish backgrounds.
Yeah, yeah. And obviously, a lot of the history that we were taught in our public school education was very misinformed and lacking, especially when it comes to Indigenous history. So a lot of the stuff that we've had to research for this episode has come from our own readings and our own research and our own cultural understandings. But we cannot possibly try to encapsulate the varied thousands of different cultures that existed pre-contact in this country. So it's kind of impossible for us to make blanket statements like I was just doing. Yeah. But, I mean, I think we can safely say there was a history of civilization here, pre-contact. So, but yeah, it's not big Aztec pyramids. It's just, it's different, but it's still sacred and important, and, like, it's still evidence of that civilization. Like, I'm just babbling at this point.
Yeah. I'll step back in. So what I was trying to say, what I was trying to lead to, is that when I think of sacred or just important long-standing Indigenous Australian sites and places, I would think of natural features curated and cared for by the Indigenous people. But I don't think of, like, big pyramids or fancy tombs or, I don't know, like, farmlands that's been around for 10,000 years or anything like that. I would think of, for example, where we grew up, there were, like, local pipi beds that were, like seafood places. Places where they, like, farmed and gathered pippies and clams and things like that out of the beach. Those were sacred places. I think of Uluru, the giant rock in the middle of the country that's a sacred space. I think of, like, forests and rivers and mountains and places like
meeting places, burial places.
Yes.
Places of trade and diplomacy, places of, like, ceremony.
Yeah. I don't think of big villages or big cities or anything along those lines. Not castles, nothing like that.
Yeah, there's no castles here.
Yeah. So in terms of magic leaving traces, I think, like, the traces of magic, if we're going all the way back to Indigenous peoples, and this is a big leap because we haven't even really talked about that, I would think of magic embedded into the natural land and into the natural environment.
Yeah, 100%. Like, it's inevitable. If they've been here for 60,000 or more years, like, it would be all around us. Like, you know, most places that you would visit, but especially places of cultural significance, would have that magical weight to them.
I would say I've even felt that, like, just in real life.
Yeah.
Visiting some of these old places or, like, beautiful natural formations that exist in Australia, which I've been to.
Yeah. It's definitely...
They feel magical.
It's hard to explain for anyone who hasn't experienced it, but it's definitely very different when you drive or travel from the coast of Australia further and further inland. The vibe changes. Like, it's a different feeling. It's a reference. It's hard to explain.
It's very hard to explain. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it feels... Yeah, there's no way to say this without biting my own tongue.
Yeah.
It feels like stepping into, like, a modern, sanitized world into something before that. Something older and more
prehistoric
ancient than that.
Because most of it is relatively untouched. Like, most of it is... I mean, obviously, the touch of colonialization spreads across this entire country, and deforestation, and the land has been permanently altered. But you can go into the bush, and you're in the bush. There's no buildings. There's no cars. Like, it's hard to explain for anyone who hasn't experienced it.
It is very possible to travel a day or so in a direction and feel like you're the only person in the world.
Yeah,
not true, but it can feel like that very, very easily.
There are spots in Australia where if you're standing there, the closest people to you are in the ISS, the International Space Station.
Yeah, that's true.
So
yeah, But yeah, there's places in Australia that are so isolated the nearest human being is in space.
Yeah.
I have personally not been to those places, but you can get the feeling.
Yeah. Natural disasters. If magic is an emotion, is our country restless and injured? Okay, so this is the point I guess I wanted to make. Ever since contact... God. Ever since contact and colonization, the environment of this country has not really been considered. That this country is very delicate. Like, it's very old, but it's very delicate. And basically, the mass capitalism and agricultural practices that were put here by the colonizing forces disrupted that balance and disrupted the respect for the land. And basically, it's just caused almost irreparable environmental damage. Like, it's wiped out species of animals, it's disrupted the food chain, the delicate balance of natural forces in this land. And I think that has been shown more than ever in the last couple of years, where there's just been consistent back-to-back natural disasters, mass extinctions, where at a point where it's almost a point of no return. It's very sad.
Climate change.
Yeah, climate change.
The greatest horror of our natural of our modern day.
Not to get too political, but basically we were in a political situation for the last decade or so where climate change was just not considered, not cared about. And so that has had a significant, significant consequences on the land and its people. So I guess the analogy I'm trying to draw here is that maybe if we're thinking of Australia as a magical land, we can think of, like, these sorts of consequences on nature and the environment as the magic here is delicate, it's temperamental, it needs to be respected. There needs to be, like, rules and reverence for it. Otherwise, if you fuck with it too much, bad things will happen, if that makes sense. Yeah. Like, you know what I'm saying? If you don't take care of the land, it's not going to take care of you.
Yeah, I think that's very true and very, like, in line with, I would say, Indigenous Australian ways of thinking about the land. Yeah, it's not something that I've ever really thought about in that kind of way, but it does speak to me as very true.
Especially in the last few years, like bushfires, floods.
Bushfires.
That's just, we weren't taking care of the land, and now all our homes are gone. Like, you know?
Yeah.
Now we're not going to have any koalas anymore, and, like, it's just... That's all very surface level things, but you get what I'm saying. Like, the environment has, it's taking back what was taken from it.
I see that. I don't know. A part of me wants to rebel against that because I feel like it's a very, what's the word? White centric? That's not a very good way of describing it. It's very arrogant to assume that, like, you know, storms and bushfires and things that just happen naturally
are about us
and are a consequence of the things we do. But also, like, quite literally, yes, floods are devastating because we build in the wrong places. And bushfires are devastating because we've eradicated our country's ability to recover from bushfires, which is something it's been doing for tens of thousands of years.
And also with the help of First Nations people.
Yeah.
And like, First Nations people were making sure that bushfires didn't completely wipe out the land.
Yeah, by cultivating and caring for the land in very specific ways. Invasive species and agriculture have, like, completely decimated natural environments and are only going to continue to do so. Like, rabbits. Introducing rabbits to our country, like, devastating. Completely ruined, like, whole sections of the natural environment. That's a whole... We could talk about rabbits in Australia for a whole episode on its own.
Honestly.
Yeah, I don't know. I agree and I disagree. Hard to say. Hard to say.
Yeah, I'm not trying to think of it in that arrogance way. I'm trying to think of it in a way of, like, if the magic is so palpable on this land, like, I'm trying to put myself in the position of, this is a magical land. I'm in a fictional universe. Like, if I could... If I, as a magic person visiting this land, could feel the magic around me, could see it, and, like, it's, like, almost, like, thick in the air.
Yeah, like, I do believe this is a country where, like, the magic exists in the stones and in the soil and in the trees and the air and the water, and, so I can very easily see, like, how an entire season of fire could feel like a magical consequence of something happening to the land. Yeah, I think that's a very valid interpretation.
What is magical flora like? Plants. So, Australia has very interesting flora. I had some points here I guess we can discuss. I'll just quickly quickfire them.
Yeah, definitely.
Australian native plants are fire and reproduction, desert, not desolate, and bush tucker. So let's have a think about those things.
Okay, well, yeah, one of the... Something that we've talked about before and that I think is something that's maybe unique to Australia, at least something that's very cool and characteristic of Australia, is the fact that our country, in terms of our flora specifically, is designed to catch on fire and burn. And I know that, like, wildfires yeah. are a part of the environment everywhere in the world. But Australia, like, we have trees that only let their seeds out post a bushfire. So, like, you actually need the trees to catch on fire and burn in order for the next generation to be born and grow. Which I think is very, very cool. Mm-hmm. It feels like we live in a country that has, like the phoenix abilities of fire and death being linked to rebirth and new life as, like, actually part of the DNA of the country.
It does make the country feel very yeah. ancient, too. Like, it's evolved to such a point where it's like, oh, you're trying to destroy me with fire? No, this is actually how I thrive. You know? Like, it's very cool.
Yeah. We also have just, like, a bunch of native trees and flora and fauna that are completely unique and distinctive to our country. I have, like, notes on that more in the mm-hmm. fauna section because I don't know trees and plants as much.
Sure.
But, yeah, we've got unique and weird plants compared to the rest of the world.
I think desert, not desolate. Like, we've already mentioned how the red center, mm-hmm. like, this country is mostly desert. It's mostly flat plains. Mm-hmm. I think I just wanted to make it quite clear that the desert is not necessarily dead, empty space. That's like, how it's referred to. But the desert is teeming with life. It's its own natural ecosystem. And I think that's just very important to emphasize.
Oh, yeah. I guess I think of deserts, probably because I live here, it didn't even occur to me to say this, but I think of deserts, like, as filled with the same amount of life as, like, a rainforest. Like, I think of them as equal in terms of, like, biodiversity and life. Just very, very different kinds of life.
Yeah. And especially life that is, like, tougher, you know? Mm-hmm. It's more accustomed to the harsh climates and the different changes in temperature and can last longer without water and things like that. It's very interesting to think about that from a magical point of view, right? Like, imagine a tree that, like, there's, like, we've heard about trees in Nepal that are gravity-defying, right? Or gravity-defying plants or something like that.
Cool.
I think we heard about that in the fourth book when Neville was reading a special plants book.
Mm-hmm. Dirigibles. Dirigible plums are one that straight away comes to me. They're the flying plums.
Yeah, they're explosive.
No, they fly.
Yeah, explosive. Oh, okay. Okay, whatever. I thought that they were explosive. Oh,
a dirigible is a kind of aircraft. They're flying plums. We see them in the eighth movie.
Yeah. Like, I can easily imagine magical plants and trees that don't mm-hmm. need water, that thrive in, like, harsh mm-hmm. sunlight and stuff like that. Like, yeah, interesting things. Another thing I had here is bush tucker and food and medicine. So, like, another great thing about the Australian natural landscape is that, obviously, there's lots of, like, land and plants that need to be cultivated mm-hmm. carefully, but there are also lots of trees and plants that need very little preparation to be consumed.
Yeah.
And that's what's, like, and so, like, I remember vividly almost every, I say every as if it's happened often, but in primary school and mm-hmm. high school, like, part of the school tour, part of the orientation was, oh, these are the plants you can eat, these are the ones you mm-hmm. can't. like that's just a part of life.
You're not crazy. Right? Definitely we would have, like, Indigenous Australian people come in and give talks to us.
Yeah.
And also, this is making it sound like our entire class was white and there were no Indigenous Australians at our school. There are also students at our school. But something that did happen is, like, we would have, like, bush tucker days where they would come in and be like, look, here's all of the plants and animals that exist in, like, our very backyards that used to be a massive part of our diet here at being the traditional custodians of the land. And I can remember going on, like, bushwalks and stuff with our school group where it's like, look, here's this tree and here's this plant and here's how it's part of our natural ecosystem. I can distinctly remember shown witchetty grubs in primary school.
Yeah.
For anyone non-Australian, witchetty grubs are, like, these big white grubs that just sort of live in the fucking dirt and in decomposing plants, and you can just pick those bad boys up off the ground and eat them. They're great.
Yeah, they're pretty tasty.
You shouldn't, but you can.
You can.
Yeah. Don't eat things loose in the ground, but it's fine to do.
Literally, the other week when you were visiting me, we went to a botanical gardens, mm-hmm. and there was plants there that you could eat.
Mm-hmm.
They say you can't. The signs up being like, please don't eat the plants. It's a natural botanical garden.
Yeah.
But
these plants are not here for you to eat, but you can eat them.
Yeah.
If you were in a survival scenario here in the botanical garden,
delicious treats. And I just wanted to bring that up because I think a lot of the times in the Harry Potter books, we hear about potions, ingredients, and herbology stuff that's, like, foreign, right? Like, you know, there are definitely things that are based in Britain, but there are things that are, like, definitely this would have had to have been imported from other parts of Europe and stuff like that. I think that, like, Australia's doing pretty good, is what I'm trying to get to. Like, sure, there'd be some things we'd have to import, there'd be trade between other countries, but I think we would find a lot of, you know, local stuff here that would assist in our herb, in our potions and spells. Like, I don't think that we would need to search far to find the ingredients we need.
Well, something that I want to touch on, and, like, I said this before, because we're a continent and we're an island nation, we're very far away from the rest of the world. One of the things that Australia is known for is our unique environment, our unique ecosystem. The reason why it's so unique is because we're so physically distant from the rest of the world. We have a closed, separate ecosystem, which has led to the evolution of a bunch of really, really unique and different animals and plants compared to the rest of the world.
Yeah.
And I'll touch more on that in the animal section.
Which I'm ready to go to now.
Okay, yeah. I'll just touch on flora first quickly. Yeah. Like, we have completely unique trees and bushes and flowers and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think in terms of potion ingredients, we've got to have pretty unique potion ingredients, maybe unique potions, like stuff that can only be brewed in Australia.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think we would do a very thriving trade shipping stuff overseas, which is very interesting. And in terms of, like, the evolution of magic here, especially since, well, post-colonization, like, you got to think it's got to start with a lot of people trying to do things the British way and then just being unable to because we don't have their shit here and they don't have our shit there.
Well, in terms of real life, Australia's biggest import is coal. That is a natural resource. Mm-hmm. If we were to look at this from a magical perspective, our natural resources would be our biggest import in a magical society. And that, and I'm imagining that would be things like the claws and stuff of specific magical fauna, but also magical flora for potion making and stuff like that. It'd be huge. Yeah.
Or, like, waratahs and wattle and eucalyptus. Like, all of those things have got to have magical properties,
Snow gum. Sorry, ghost gum, I should say.
Ghost gum. Yeah. Ghost gum. Oh, ghost gum in potions. Hells yeah. Gum nuts. Okay. So, one thing that, like, I've got ideas for magical creatures. Do you have any ideas for magical plants? Because I've only kind of got one, really.
I've got one idea.
Oh, I've got maybe two. You go.
One idea, which is so specific. We have some coconut palms here in Australia. And I like to think that the coconut shavings or part of that coconut palm, if you were to consume that or throw it around a space, it would reveal things that are hidden, invisible things because of possum magic. Now, for those who don't know, possum magic is a classic Australian children's book in which a possum is invisible and asks its auntie or mother for, I think it's grandmother possum, asks grandmother possum, who's a witch, basically, to help him become visible again. And she makes him lamingtons with coconut on it and he can become visible again. So that's just a fun little tale.
Okay, my ideas for magical plants. First of all, I was just talking about this, but we have plants that grow in fire. I think we should have some kind of phoenix tree that catches on fire and grows in fire, because I think that's sick.
Some sort of
I want a fire tree.
Eternal tree, yeah, definitely. Flame trees, as they say.
Flame trees, yeah, cool.
Yeah.
I like the idea that sometimes we have spontaneous bushfires here in Australia because they just start. Yeah. I think it would be cool if they were started by a specific cunt tree that burned down everything else.
I need to reproduce!
Yeah. Another Australian tree that this is like, whenever I think of Australia flora, this is the distinctive one for me, is a paper bark tree.
Oh yeah.
Which is a kind of gum tree where the bark of the tree is like this soft papery stuff and you can just peel it off. You can just grab a bunch of bark and just peel it loose and you've got a big, like almost like a roll of paper that can actually be written on and used as paper. It should be processed a little bit, but you can just use it like raw off the tree.
Parchment.
Yeah, exactly. We used to have one of these in our backyard growing up. Do you remember? Yeah,
we'd write notes on it.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, so they use parchment in Harry Potter, which is made out of animal skin. First of all, we haven't even talked about the logistics of that. It doesn't make any sense, but whatever. I think it would be very cool if we had a kind of magical paper bark tree that was how they... That's the paper that they use. Mm. Witches and wizards use paper bark for everything instead of parchment.
I like that. That's nice.
Yeah, that's cool.
Banksia. Banksia is the fire reproducing one.
Oh, okay, perfect. So Banksia would be our cunt fire tree.
I mean, surely eucalyptus oil and eucalyptus stuff like that, leaves and stuff like that.
Eucalyptus is definitely completely distinct to Australia, because I know that a big, big issue with trying to get koalas in foreign zoos is that koalas will only eat eucalyptus. The leaves from eucalyptus trees, and you have to basically grow like an entire plantation of eucalyptus trees to support a population of koalas in a zoo. So Australia has incredibly strict rules about what other countries' zoos are allowed to borrow koalas, because they have to prove that they can grow and sustain a food source for the koalas, because otherwise they'll fucking die there if anything goes wrong with shipping lanes, or they can't get leaves imported from Australia.
Yeah.
Exported from Australia, I should say.
I can definitely see eucalyptus oils being used for, like, sleeping drafts and stuff like that, because it's a very soothing sleeping stuff.
Well, that's what it's used for here. Medicines and in beauty products and stuff. It's used to calm and soothe.
Another really cool use of eucalyptus plants and eucalyptus leaves is in some indigenous ceremonies that I have been to, I have seen they basically put eucalyptus branches and leaves in the fire to create the smoke for the smoking ceremony. And the smoke smells and feels amazing. I don't know if you've ever been to one of those, but it feels so nice. It smells like, you know, usually when you're at a campfire and the smoke gets in your eyes and like they feel so stingy and you feel like you want to poke them out. Not at all. Like, you can be bathed in all this smoke and it just feels amazing. So definitely eucalyptus is coming in handy, I would say.
Oh, I love the... Okay, we don't really have fireplaces here, but like in Harry Potter, there's fireplaces and fires in every room. Imagine how good all of them are, like, eucalyptus fires.
Oh, yeah.
And instead of terrible bad smoke, like, every house smells amazing and it's all relaxing and beautiful all the time.
Yeah.
Oh, we might get a chance to touch on that later.
Yeah, maybe more culture and society. Yeah.
Let's get into fauna. I'm very excited to talk about magical creatures. But first of all, Australia's got fucked animals, guys.
Yeah.
And let's go start through some of the big, most notable ones. We've got kangaroos, koalas, dingoes, sugar gliders, possums, echidnas, platypus. We've just got like a bunch of fucked weird animals.
Yeah.
And also birds. We've got so many birds. Yeah. Galahs, cockatoos, lorikeets, emus, and cassowaries. Mm-hmm. We've got all kinds of stuff. But I feel like we tend to draw attention to those big, like, flashy, distinctive Australian animals, like emus and kangaroos.
Yeah.
I feel like a lot of our really, really distinctly Australian animals are snakes and spiders.
Yeah, reptiles and insects are big ones, yeah.
Yes, we have so many spiders and so many snakes that are particularly deadly compared to the rest of the world and unique to Australia. Isn't it something like 9 of the 10 most venomous snakes in the world are Australian?
I think maybe 7 or 9. Yeah, that sounds right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's crazy. We just have, like, incredibly dangerous shit that just lives here and is just loose.
That being said, I don't feel in danger here when I'm walking around. No. Because a lot of it is just good sense. By it, I mean, like, how to not get killed by a dangerous animal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Something that's been touched on in other Australian podcasts that I listen to, because I like to listen to other Australian voices.
Yeah.
Something that's definitely been touched on is Australians have a weirdly cavalier attitude towards our deadly flora and fauna. Mm. Like, it's very common to, for example, have a bunch of outdoor furniture that's just like, oh, just be careful when you sit there, because those, like, chairs and tables are full of redback spiders, which is an incredibly dangerous spider. That would be, like, the equivalent of Americans being like, oh, yeah, our outdoor lawn furniture is covered in black widow spiders, but we just still sit there and use it.
Yeah.
It's still functional furniture. It's just covered in spiders that will kill you if they bite you.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's not really something that happens in the rest of the world. But here it's like, oh yeah, the rock pools where we used to play as children did have blue ring octopus in them.
Yeah.
But we still swam there. You just don't stick your hands under the rocks or whatever.
Yeah. We swim in the ocean all the time and it does have, like, great whites and blue ring octopuses and box jellyfish in there. Notably, do you remember when we would go in the boat on the river near our home? And we would swim in that river, and then we found out, like, a couple kilometres down the river, because we'd see signs saying, do not swim in the river, there's bull sharks in there.
Yeah.
Like, bull sharks, like, if you don't know this about sharks, great whites are given a lot of bad rap, but bull sharks are a lot more dangerous and territorial and aggressive than a great white. A great white is, like, just a big puppy dog, basically.
Yeah. A great white is just, like, a big animal that doesn't give a shit about you or anything about you. Bull sharks are like how great whites act in movies. Yeah.
They have a personality, like, and it's a cunt. That's what I mean.
Yeah. Like the Jaws shark. Bruce from Jaws, who, like, actively hates everyone and wants to kill them. That's a bull shark. And they're small and they live in rivers and they want to kill you specifically. And I can, off the top of my head, think of at least 3 rivers that I used to swim in as a child that just had bull sharks in them.
Yeah.
And it's just like, well, if you see one, get out of the water.
At our high school, we had a river that we used for swimming classes because we went to a public school.
Yeah, that's
school.
One of the rivers.
Yeah, we went to a public school. And it was, yeah, full of bull sharks and stingrays. I vividly remember doing kayaking in that river for sport once and a child putting his oar in the river like a spatula under a pancake and lifting a stingray and flinging it out of the water. Like, and everyone was just like, oh, don't do that. Like, if,
yeah,
like you said, cavalier.
Yeah, leave it alone, man.
Yeah.
I can vividly remember going and doing swimming lessons for high school in that river right around the time that Steve Irwin famously died from a stingray and being like, okay, so the stingray's in the river in our usual swimming place today, so we're going to swim 20 meters down from there. Don't go where the stingrays are.
Yeah.
Like, famously, he had just died from a stingray, and like the next day at school, it's like, okay, get in the stingray infested waters, children.
Yeah. I remember being vividly told, like, yeah, the stingray's in the water. So remember, if you get stung, don't pull the barb out because that's what kills you. All right, kids, in the water.
Leave it in there. Like, leave it in and we'll get to a hospital.
It's as simple as that. Just don't pull it out. Come on, Jeremy. Yeah. Wake up.
Okay, enough about our memories of animals. Okay, I want to talk briefly on the canon Australian animals. Sure. Because we have very few of them. The first one is my favorite, and I think it rocks, the billywig.
Yeah.
I've mentioned this guy before. He's an insect about half an inch long, vivid sapphire blue, extremely quick so muggles don't see him. He's got a long stinger, and when he stings you, you get giddy and levitate.
Yeah.
Aussie teens like to get stung on purpose because it's basically like getting high, but if you do it too much, you can get you can end up hovering for days.
Yeah.
They're believed to be an ingredient in fizzing whizbies, and I love this fucked up little bug. I think that's perfect for Australia. Uniquely venomous, silly, stupid,
great. It feels almost personal. Like, that feels, it feels like a personal attack that that is so perfect for Australia.
Yeah. It's like
a bug that makes you high.
Bug that gets you high. We love to sting ourselves with it on purpose.
Like, it feels too real.
Yeah. Yeah. It feels like JK looked into the soul of an Australian teenager and pulled that out.
Yeah, it's awful.
I think we want to talk about this one in more detail, but the only that we know of native Australian dragon is the Antipodean?
Okay.
I don't know how to say that word. The opal-eye dragon, which is actually not native to Australia. It's a New Zealand dragon, which migrates here in search of territory.
Okay, then why even bother that?
Yeah.
It's not even exactly.
But it's apparently inspired by the rainbow serpent, which I want to talk about more, which is an Australian Dreamtime myth. Okay. So this is a New Zealand dragon, lives in valleys, not mountains, which is unique among dragons. One of the most beautiful dragons for its pearly scales and glittering multicolored eyes. So it's not even it's like not an rainbow. Opal dragon. It's like a white dragon.
Yeah, that sucks.
No pupils, not aggressive. It rarely kills except when hungry and it eats mostly sheep. It is loyal and the least dangerous and deadly kind of dragon. It's inspired by the rainbow serpent, which I don't like.
I don't like that. It's not it. It's not it for me. Rainbow serpent, I'm a big fan. Anyway.
Okay. I definitely want to talk more about the rainbow serpent because let's talk about that when we talk about our headcanons for Australian magical creatures. But that's just touching on what's canon. So the Letherfold, which is the evil cloak that kills you in your sleep, but they're not just Australian, they're tropical, but they are in Australia. So won't dwell on that. And then in our oceans, we have the remora, which is a giant fish, and sea serpents. They're just in the oceans around us. And then there are the magical animals that are found worldwide. The ones that I agree with that are in Australia, Ashwinder, kind of fire snake, fire salamander, fire lizard. Yeah. I've written bigs here. What is a big? I don't know what that says. All the ones that are bugs and fish. That's what I mean. All the ones that are bugs and fish. That's fine. Fairies. I think we have fairies. Here are the ones that I disagree with. Neasels. Australia doesn't have cats. Yep. Winged horses, we don't have horses. Yep. Moon calf, we don't have any kind of like hoofed cow animal native to Australia. Werewolves, we don't have wolves unless you count dingoes. So unless we have were-dingoes, I don't think we have werewolves native to Australia. They can be introduced, obviously.
Okay.
Yep. Okay. So let's talk about headcanon.
Okay. So I've got some points here that we can consider. So the mythology of the dreaming. Cryptids. Yep. So like classic Australian cryptids. Australian native animals and then maybe their magical variations, introduced species and such as pests, introduced species from historical immigration of populations, consider China, Indonesia, and New Zealand.
Yeah.
So let's have a think.
Okay. I was looking mostly at like what I think is native Australian because introduced species, we can just be like, stuff has come from anywhere. But Australia does have like very, well, recently, because we fucked up.
Mm.
Australia has very strict policies about what can be introduced because we're trying to minimize invasive species. Because we have such a unique environment, invasive species are completely devastating here.
Yeah.
So we have to be really strict about what's allowed in, and we have very strict customs and immigration policies in terms of what you can and can't bring into the country.
Yeah.
Something that I was thinking about in terms of native Australian animals, and this is getting more into the history side of things, so we'll put kind of a pin in it, but the International Statute of Secrecy was in place before Australia was discovered.
Yeah.
So
before Australia was colonized, yeah.
Before Australia was colonized, yeah. Sorry, when I say discovered, I mean by white people.
Yeah.
Because obviously it existed before that. What if when, like, colonizers first came here, when the first fleet, when Captain Cook's ships first showed up here and they found a bunch of fucking wild animals,
yeah.
What if a lot of them were just magical animals? Like, what if a platypus is just a magic animal, but there was no statute of secrecy here keeping them hidden?
Hmm.
So white settlers rocked up and they're like, what's this fucked up little, I don't know, ocean rat?
Send it back home.
Yeah, what is this?
Because that's literally what happened. They sent it back home to British scientists and they're like, this is fake. Shut up.
Yeah, this is fake. This isn't a real animal. Like,
yeah.
When people heard about, like, kangaroos and things, they're like, no, those animals don't exist. They're impossible. They can't exist.
Mm.
So what if things like echidnas and platypus, who are monotremes, and they are the only mammals that, like, lay eggs.
Yeah.
What if they are just magical animals that just couldn't be hidden by the magical community quickly enough before Muggles found out about them?
Look, it's a fair point. It's a fair point indeed. Like, because when you think about some of the skills of magical creatures, they are things like, oh yeah, they're venomous, but they're like a little mole thing. And it's like, well, yeah, that's a platypus. It's like, you know, it's aquatic, but it's also a little mammal monotreme thing that lays eggs and is venomous. Like, and it has, and it can send out electrical pulses to see. Like, it does sound insane when you say it like that.
But it lays eggs and then feeds its young milk. It, closes its eyes and then sees with electricity underwater. It's got a duck bill and a beaver tail and it looks like a big rat.
It's got webbed feet and it's got a venomous barb.
And it's adorable and it loves people.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm convinced this is a magical creature.
Yeah, look, you're right. You're right to say it, and you should say it.
Yeah.
So
in terms of magical creatures, like, a ton of the British magical creatures are like, hey, this is like a normal bird, but it's venomous. I think a ton of our snakes and spiders are just magical snakes and spiders. It's like, hey, take a regular spider, make it bigger, aggressive, and super venomous. That's a fucking, what are they called?
Funnel web.
Funnel web, yeah. That's a funnel web, baby.
I know exactly who you're talking about.
Yeah, you know exactly who I mean.
Literally, I can
this motherfucker.
I can see the entry in, like, what is it called? Fucking Magical Creatures and Where to Find Them? Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them. It's like, oh, this Australian spider likes to hide in unaware people's shoes and, like, bite anyone who puts their foot in there. That's literally what they do. They hide in shoes.
They hide in shoes and they bite you when you stick your feet in. So you got to bang your shoes on the door frame to shake them out before you put your shoes on. If you leave your shoes outside like a fuckwit, never leave your shoes outside. That's how the spiders get in them.
Yeah, it really does seem like that.
Really just like, this is a regular spider, but it's three times the size of a regular spider, super aggressive, will rear up and run at you, and like 10 times as dangerous in terms of... And it's got like 10 times the amount of venom a regular spider should have. That's just like, that's just what magical beasts are.
Yeah, it's true.
Yeah.
I'd like to think a little bit about magical variations of native animals, though.
Yes.
Something that, like, maybe people don't know. There is an Australian creature from the Dreaming called a bunyip and also a yowie.
Yes.
So
these are two distinct animals.
When I say the Dreaming, by the way.
Oh, yeah, we should explain the Dreaming as well.
So the Dreaming is the First Nations people's understanding of the world and its creation. Mm-hmm. So it's passed from generation to generation through storytelling and shares beliefs that are connected to country and the natural world. So it's quite often that, like, in the modern Australia today, you'll hear Dreaming stories about why natural things are the way they are. Why kangaroos have tails.
Yes.
Why all the birds are muted in colour and stuff like that. Well, how the birds got their colours, sorry.
Yeah.
Like, all these sorts of things.
The Dreaming is the Indigenous Australian creation myth and, like, auditory history. It's, like, it's their folklore, their mythology, their stories.
And it's still going.
It's still going, yeah.
Yeah. So, yowies and bunyips. Yowies and bunyips are creatures from the Dreaming Bunyips are basically, it's hard to describe because there's lots of different descriptions of what they look like, but they are water-based creatures. They can be benevolent, they can be malevolent, and similarly with bunyips, except they're not water-based creatures. They're sort of like, a bunyip's kind of like an Australian a Bigfoot, yowie. Sort of. It's
yeah, sorry.
Yowie, sorry. A yowie's like an Australian Bigfoot. I should, yeah, okay. So how I've always pictured it is a bunyip is kind of like platypus-esque because it's water-based, and a yowie is more kangaroo-esque because I picture it as moving quite quickly over land. So that's just how I've always pictured them.
So, yeah, like you said, bunyips are very varied.
Yeah.
Sorry. I think bunyips might actually be different in terms of different places in Australia and different, like, dreamings that they come from. I've heard them described as anything from, like, big frogs to, like, hippopotamus-type creatures. But they are definitely some sort of aquatic creature. And like you said, they can be, like, dangerous and they kill you and eat your blood or whatever. Or they can be completely benevolent and they grant a wish or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, yeah, we definitely have some kind of mysterious bunyip creature. And a yowie, I've heard, once again, anything from, like, a possum-sized thing to a full-on humanoid, like, six-foot-tall hairy ape thing. It is definitely, it's our answer to the Bigfoot. It's our local Sasquatch is a yowie.
So I definitely like to think of, like, a bigger platypus sort of, like, creature for a bunyip and a bigger magical version of a kangaroo for a yowie. That's what I like to think of in my brain. But artistic liberty. I'd love to see other people's interpretations.
Yeah. Very cool. Yeah. I love the bunyip and the yowie. I've got more Dreamtime animals that I think we can talk about.
Let's go. Let's hear about it.
Well, yeah, let's start with the rainbow serpent, because I think we both want to have a native Australian dragon.
Yeah.
And let's talk about the rainbow serpent. We were just talking about the Dreamtime.
I love the rainbow serpent.
Would you like to hear the Dreamtime story of the rainbow serpent? Just to give, also to give our listeners, like, an example of what Dreamtime stories are like.
Yeah, I would love to hear that.
Okay, so this is a couple of paragraphs long, so it'll take a minute, but just listen to this beautiful story. The Rainbow Serpent. Long ago, in the Dreamtime, when the earth lay sleeping and nothing moved or grew, lived the Rainbow Serpent. Then one day, the Rainbow Serpent awoke and came out from beneath the earth. Refreshed from her long slumber, she travelled far and wide, leaving winding tracks from her huge body and then returning to the place she had first appeared. On her return, she called out to the frogs, "Come out!" The frogs come out slowly, as their bellies were full of water which they had stored during their long sleep. The rainbow serpent tickled their stomachs, and when the frogs laughed, the water spilled out all over the earth to fill the tracks of the rainbow serpent. This is how the lakes and the rivers were first formed. With water, grass and trees began to grow, which woke all the animals, who then followed the rainbow serpent across the land. They were happy on earth, and each lived and gathered food with their own tribe. Some animals lived in rocks, some on the vast plains, and others in the trees and in the sky. The rainbow serpent made laws which they were all to obey, but some began to make trouble and argue. The rainbow serpent said, "Those who keep my laws will be rewarded. I will give them human form. Those who break my laws will be punished and turned to stone and will never walk the earth again. Those who broke the law became stone and were turned into mountains and hills. And those who were obedient were turned into human form, and were each given their own totem of the animal, bird, or reptile from where they began. The tribes knew themselves by their totems, kangaroo, emu, carpet snake, and many, many more. So no one would starve. The rainbow serpent ruled that no man would eat of his totem, but only of other totems. That way there was food for everyone. The tribes lived together on the land given to them by the rainbow serpent, or mother of life, and knew the land would always be theirs, so no one could ever take it from them." So this is a story, it's like a creation myth, basically. And the rainbow serpent is the origin of rivers and life and animals in the country.
Yeah. I love her.
Yeah, I've heard the rainbow serpent referred to as both male, female, and neither, but I've mostly heard them referred to as female, so I tend to use she, her pronouns for the rainbow serpent.
I like to use a mix of all of them, and especially they, them pronouns, because I also know the rainbow serpent is very closely associated with First Nations people that are queer. So
hells yes.
And there's lots of identification with sister boys and brother girls and the rainbow serpent. So I think it's very cool to use they, them, she, her, he, his pronouns interchangeably with the rainbow serpent.
Yeah.
Rainbow serpent for all of us.
Rainbow serpent, beautiful, powerful, magical. Yeah. As far as I know, the most important, like, creation myth and creation figure in Australia, in Indigenous dreaming, but I'm not an expert in dreaming. There might be others.
Certainly one of the most iconic and important ones.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So building from that and, like, building from mythology and turning it into Harry Potter, which is what JK does. Let's make a cool rainbow dragon that we get to have.
Basically, long, serpent-like dragon that's aquatic is mm-hmm. what I'm picturing. And obviously colourful.
Colourful.
Really colourful. You know how, like, when you look at light, like an invisible light, it's sort of rainbow? Is that right?
Iridescent.
Iridescent light. Mm. But also, like, sometimes when light refracts through something, it's rainbow. That's how we get rainbows in the sky.
Yeah.
That's how I imagine it. Like, sometimes you can't even behold the rainbow serpent. They're just so stunning, you know?
Well, what I was thinking was opals are native to Australia as well, aren't they? Like, opals don't occur anywhere else?
If not native, they're certainly iconic
yeah.
to Australia.
I thought opals only existed in Australia or came from here, whatever.
I don't know.
Opal mines are a massive thing in the Australian desert. So yeah. I kind of like the idea that the scales of our rainbow dragon are like opal.
Mm-hmm.
So like dark, either very dark or very like pure bright white and filled with little flecks of all the different kinds of colours. I think that's what the rainbow dragon looks like. Yeah, it definitely lives in rivers and lakes, so probably not way out in the desert, probably more around the edges of Australia and in the coast.
I think they move around. I think she just goes where she goes.
Travels the entire country.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think probably, like, I was thinking of the opal-eye dragon in canon that feeds on sheep. Well, we don't have sheep native here, so I think it feeds on a lot of, like, fish and bugs and frogs and lizards and things like that.
Yeah. All sorts of stuff.
Yeah. And hibernates for a long time in the water.
Yeah. And I think he's definitely benevolent as well.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Friendly, rainbow, beautiful rainbow serpent.
Cool.
So I love her.
I've been very distinctive about calling it the rainbow dragon because I don't want to call it the rainbow serpent.
I want to call her the rainbow serpent.
Well, the rainbow serpent is a real thing from The Dreaming. I'm trying to make up a fake dragon that exists in Harry Potter world.
Okay.
I don't want to say it's the rainbow serpent because that feels appropriate.
Okay, fair.
Yeah. Right. If this is a dragon inspired by the rainbow serpent.
Sure. Yeah.
Okay, let's talk about some other animals. So the other creature from the Australian Dreaming that I think would be relevant in terms of Harry Potter magical creatures is the Yarramayahu, which is our Australian vampire.
Yeah.
And these aren't like cool Dracula sort of vampires.
They're cooler.
They're much, much cooler, but much less sexy.
Yeah.
So they are little, like, little red goblin men. I'm holding up my hands to indicate the size of them, but listeners, you cannot see. They're small. They're little, like, I think 3 foot at the most. Red, like, goblin men with frog-like appearances. They live up in trees, especially in fig trees. They have octopus suckers on their hands, and they drop down out of the trees, grab a hold of you, drink all of your blood through the suckers in their hands, and then when you pass out from blood loss, they swallow you whole, take a big nap, and usually a big drink of water and then a big nap, and then when they wake up from their nap, they spit you out whole and you are smaller and redder, and if that happens to you too many times, you become a Yarramayahu. I love these motherfuckers.
Yeah, they're great.
They're great. Perfect. No notes. They just exist. We've got them.
They're there. Don't fall asleep under a tree. You might get et by a Yarramayahu.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Cryptids. Classic Australian cryptid is the drop bear.
Mm-hmm.
It's basically an evil koala, like evil tree bear that will just drop down on you and kill you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Bite you, take apart. Yeah. That seems right. We've definitely got drop bears. I love if they sort of live amongst koalas and are disguised as koalas, but are not koalas.
Yeah. I'd like to offer another alternative, trapdoor bears. Similar, but it's just a wombat version.
Oh, fuck yes. Trapdoor bears is so good. Like a trapdoor spider. God, you're hilarious. Yeah.
Because you know how when you're in the bush and they always say you need to stomp so the snakes stay away from you? Imagine, like, you stomp too hard or you stomp on a trapdoor bear's trapdoor and it just comes up and pulls you down.
Love the idea of getting pulled into a hole in the ground by a terrible wombat. Drop bears from the trees and trapdoor bears from below? Fuck yes. Australia's great. What a great country. Everyone should live here. other cryptids we have is the panthers. Do you know about these?
Oh, Wait, no, I don't.
What are these? Oh, no.
I thought I did, but I'm like, no, I don't.
Okay, I've heard them called both the Otways Panther and the Blue Mountains Panther. So okay. Blue Mountains are a place in New South Wales, and the Otways are like a national park down in Victoria, so two separate places in Australia. There have been at least 30 years worth of sightings of panthers living there. Just a fucking group of panthers loose in the wild. There have been several investigations into this by like scientists, law enforcement, the government. There's no record of real panthers living there, but the rumor persists today that there are loose panthers. So
interesting.
I think it's cool if we've got like some kind of demiguise type panther.
Yeah, just, I was about to say.
Yeah, like either they turn invisible or they teleport, blink panthers, you know.
Yeah.
I think it's cool if we've got a native Australian panther that lives in mountains and our national parks.
Also, if we're going to talk about demiguise, like I've got here in my notes, introduced species from historical immigration. We know that especially in the mid-1800s, there was a huge immigration to Australia from China.
Mm-hmm.
The demiguy is a Chinese mythical creature, right? Magical creature?
I'm not sure off the top of my head.
Let me just triple check that. I'm pretty sure in Fantastic Beasts it says it's a Chinese creature. Native to Far East. Okay.
Okay, that could be a place. Anywhere. Look,
well, the Far East.
It's from somewhere in Asia, we don't know.
It might be China.
Far East does sound like code for China.
Because that is part of Eastern Asia. Anyway, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
If it was from China. And we have that Chinese immigration in the mid-1800s. Imagine if demiguises came across some magical panthers and there was crossbreeding and now we have invisible magical panthers. Like,
love the idea of that.
Yeah.
I said earlier that Australia doesn't have native cats. I would love this to be the exception. Like, we don't think we have native cats because they're invisible.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Another one I want to put forward. Dingoes, but they can talk.
Yep, talking dingoes, perfect. Love that.
Yeah.
Well, what I like about that is that often, like, a trickster spirit in folklore is whatever kind of fucked up dog a place has. Like, coyotes, foxes, those things are often, like, tricksters. I would like it if dingoes were that for Australia.
Jackals. Yeah.
Jackals, yeah, absolutely. That's another one. The other, like, well-known Australian cryptid that I have is the Hawkesbury River Monster. Do you know this guy?
No.
Okay. Why don't you know any cryptids? I feel like I live and breathe these guys. Okay. So the Hawkesbury River is in New South Wales, also known as the Moonee Moonee Monster. Anecdotal sightings of this mystic cryptid creature were reported in the 1800s, so when we were first colonized. Although Aboriginal rock art in the region describing a similar creature known as the Mooleywonk dates back more than 3,000 years.
Wow.
So this guy's legit.
It's been around.
He's basically our Loch Ness monster.
Oh, excellent.
But instead of being like a plesiosaur type thing, he's a giant eel.
Oh, fantastic.
Huge, huge, like sea serpent level eel, all grey. And he does have flippers and a tail. Love this guy.
I love that.
He's perfect. Swimming goanna is a way he's been described.
Wow. Fuck yeah, perfect. I'd like to also petition for an Australian mermaid,
mm-hmm.
but H2O just add water style, where like they can walk on land, but the instant they get wet, they have to go dive in the water because they're going to turn into a mermaid.
Very cool.
Yeah.
I was going to argue for, so we know that in Harry Potter, there are like, so the mermaids, they have, I'm not going to describe them. Picture the ones that appear in the fourth movie. They're like the Irish Celtic sort of mermaids where they're like kelpie and they're grey. What I would like is if we had tropical Great Barrier Reef mermaids. I want bright colours fitting in with the coral, venomous.
Yeah.
That's the kind of mermaid I want. Like a lionfish style tail. Very cool.
Definitely. That's what I want for, like, what's the fucking, the Grindylows? How the Grindylows are, like, all dark and creepy. I want that, but, like, beautiful, colourful, venomous, startling. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what I want for our Great Barrier Reef and that. Yeah. And then, like, H2O moments that just...
Tropical versions like, of the, like, Irish, British ones that we see in the series.
Yeah.
Also be very cool if we had river mermaids that were, like, platypus-typey mermaids.
Yeah, like a selkie.
Like a selkie. Like a
platypus vibe.
Yeah. Platypus selkie, very good.
Yeah, nice.
Okay, while we're talking on, like, variations of things from Harry Potter series, phoenixes in Harry Potter are native to Africa. I want to argue that they're native to Australia as well. I want to give us a fucking firebird.
Yeah, definitely we have a variation of the phoenix. It makes sense.
Yeah. We should have an Australian phoenix. I want a bird that catches fire. That's perfect for our country.
Yeah, yeah.
Also, we are supposed to have fairies because fairies are worldwide. In Australia, we have gumnut babies.
Yeah, classic.
Which are like tiny little babies that have gumnuts, which are a kind of native Australian nut flower thing they wear as hats, and they like frolic in the plants and have little mischievous adventures. I think our fairies should be gumnut babies.
Oh, yeah, I like that.
Yeah. Google gumnut babies if you don't know what I'm talking about. They're like a children's story.
Yeah. Famously, I dressed up as one when I was a baby. It was very
cute. Famously. We all know that.
We all know this.
Yeah.
I
dressed as the Southern Cross when you dressed as a gumnut baby. That was for our Australian-themed party. Dad dressed as a fly. I don't remember what Mum dressed as.
Maybe Mum came as, like, the flag or something? I don't know.
Maybe Mum was dressed as the Southern Cross and I was dressed as something else.
Hmm.
Can't remember now. You were definitely a gumnut baby.
Yeah, because I was a baby. Anyway,
you were a baby.
I would like to put forward a petition for some kind of creature that's a mimic, because famously in Australia we have a lyrebird. A lyrebird is...
Lyrebird.
One of our fucked up birds that basically, part of its mating ritual is it mimics impressive sounds to try and impress a mate and attract a mate.
Mm-hmm.
And so what will often happen is if you're traipsing through the bush, stomping through the bush to make sure you don't attract any snakes, is you might hear a cell phone go off. But it's not a cell phone, it's a lyrebird, because it's just heard a cell phone play before and it copies that sound to attract a mate. It's very impressive.
I love that they go out looking for cool sounds.
Yeah,
very good. And also, if you've never heard these things, like YouTube lyrebird calls, they perfectly mimic sounds. It's the spookiest shit you've ever seen. Like, imagine a bird opens its mouth and, like, a fucking YouTube ad promo comes out. Like, it's crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So definitely they're terrifying. Some sort of bird that mimics you, but I think a bunch of other creatures, like insects, maybe even humanoid-looking creatures that are, like, little mimics. Mm. Terrifying.
I want to put forward for our magical lyrebird a bird that doesn't mimic, it steals your voice.
Oh, good.
So, like, if you... Yeah.
Perfect.
If you fuck, around... If you fuck around, you find this bird will take your voice and you won't be able to say that specific phrase the bird stole from you anymore.
Oh, God. Yep.
Love that.
Yeah.
You would have to use non-verbal spells to defeat it, because if you say the spell name out loud, it takes the word and you can't say that word
that
anymore.
That makes a lot of sense. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
That's very cool.
Yep, nice.
Do Australia have some sort of, like, man that comes out of the dark and gets you? Like, do we have anything like that? Like, I'm thinking, like, a rake or a hollow like man or Slender Man
or something, or,
I don't think so. I think those are more of a modern type of cryptid. Oh, actually, no, like a skinwalker or something.
Sure, sure. I mean, that to me, just a man in the dark or something creepy coming out of the dark, that's what it's like to be in the bush at night.
Yeah.
You know, when you're walking around the bush at night and you look up into the sky and you see what seems to be like a CD opener opening and there's this big light in the sky and then it just goes away.
No.
Yeah.
Okay.
Or sometimes you're walking around the bush and you see a man, you're like, oh, there's a man up there, and then he turns into a tree. And you're like, okay.
I like tree man. Tree man I'm interested in. Yeah, I don't think we really have, like, skinwalkers or anything. I don't think we have, like, mimic people. I'm looking for, like, fake humanoid people. I don't think we have that. We've got yaoi's, but that's the closest to it. We've most got animals and stuff.
Yeah, yeah. I like the idea of having some skinwalkers, though, or maybe, like, men that turn into trees, or, like, some sort of dark, shadowy creature that turns into a tree. Like, a hide-behind vibe, but more like a shapeshifter.
Hide-behind, yeah.
Yeah.
I think men that turn into trees is good, because I know that in the dreaming, there are all kinds of stories of, like, people who turn into trees, or trees who turn into people, or people who turn into animals, or animals who turn into people. Like, that's a really, really common part of creation myths, is animals and trees becoming people, and vice versa. Like, it was in the Rainbow Serpent story that I just read out.
Anora and the Black Crane.
Oh, yeah, Black Crane's got to be part of our... We've got to have a native animal. Magical.
That dreaming story always terrified me, to be honest. If you
it's
wanna,
deeply terrifying.
If you want to look up something terrifying, look up Anora and the Black Crane.
Yeah, that's the closest to a horror story the dreaming has. I want to put forward some kind of big shark, because we've got great whites and I love them. I want megalodons to still be around in the Australian Great Bight, where the sharks live.
Oh, I didn't even think megafauna. You know how megafauna was
megafauna
here pre-historically?
I was gonna suggest as well.
Just like massive wombats.
Mm-hmm.
I reckon they're still around.
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely. So in Australia, one thing that our native animals don't have is we don't have big, big native animals. The biggest we've got is like a kangaroo or an emu or something.
And they're like human size.
They're like human size, but other countries have things like moose and buffalo and horse and like they've got big animals, hippos, elephants. We don't have any of those. We've got small, scuttly little animals. But we used to have megafauna. We used to have giant sloths, giant wombats, like big, big animals. I think it would be cool if those guys were still around.
Yeah. I think I've read before that there is history that, like, First Nations people did hunt and work with these animals, these huge megafauna. Like, that's just insane to me. Like, that's prehistory. That's so long ago. But there's apparently depictions and oral histories of it, like... It's crazy, like, how long
this is true.
First Nations people have been here.
This is what we were talking about, longest surviving culture. We have, like, art and oral histories of hunting and eating ancient megafauna, wombats and stuff.
Yeah, it's
Australia's incredible. Got so much cool history.
I think we can talk a little bit about introduced species. Like, obviously, the best example here is, what were we trying to get rid of that we introduced the rabbits?
Rabbits, cane toads. Those are the
what was
two
the original
ones.
Thing we were trying to get rid of? Maybe feral cats and dogs or something like that. Or...
it would have just been like the colonizer ships came over. They would have had cats, dogs, rats, all of their stock animals, cows and goats and shit, all that stuff.
So all these feral cats and dogs, and obviously the rabbits, just bred like rabbits and destroyed the environment, the agriculture, and the natural environment.
Because they didn't have any natural predators. Because our predator animals are all like snakes and spiders and shit and dingoes. Yeah. We don't have anything that really takes out native cats and dogs. Invasive cats and dogs.
So what the colonizers decided to do was introduce cane toads to get rid of the rabbits and poison them, but it didn't work.
No.
And so now we have a bunch of fucking cane toads infesting the land as well. So I think about that in a magical context too. Like, there's definitely got to be some introduced magical species that have just fucking taken over. I think a big one would be Cornish pixies, to be honest. I could definitely see that.
Yeah, I can see pixies taking off here.
Yeah.
Although I can also see them getting absolutely torn apart by birds. I think we have cool native birds. We haven't touched on owls as well. We've got to do that.
Land-based sort of things, like those little gnomes or whatever they are.
Yeah. Many of our native animals are like little marsupial type things, like possums.
Yeah.
Anything that can fit in with those is going to be okay.
Yeah. So that's just something to consider. But that's all I have on fauna.
Well, I think we should touch on birds, because neither of us like talking about birds. I think we definitely have some kind of evil cassowary.
Yeah.
Or maybe conversely, we have a good cassowary, because cassowaries are already evil.
Benevolent. Cassowaries are just magical creatures that, again, cross that divide between magic and human.
Yeah. Something, I just got to touch on this because it just happened. We recently got beautiful fan art, which I lost my fucking mind over, which one of our favorite pieces was us talking about the cassowaries and how evil they are, and that brought up that conversation that we had. And then, like you said, we went to the botanical gardens when we recently had a visit, and there was a statue of a cassowary there that was the size of a human. And I'm like, oh, why did they make a giant cassowary statue? And all of you were like, no, that's how big a cassowary is.
They're
and
massive.
I almost died of fear.
Yeah.
I was under the impression that a cassowary was about the size of, like, a real-life velociraptor, like a big dog.
No.
I thought they were small.
Well, first of all, velociraptors were bigger than dogs.
No, yeah, but like a velociraptor is like a big turkey sort of thing.
Sure, but...
like a Labrador is how big I thought a cassowary was. They're like the size of a human.
Yeah, they're like a little bit smaller than emus, but yeah, I've seen them in real life. They're scary. They're big.
Yeah, I also have, but I guess I just wiped it out of my brain because it was too terrifying.
Yeah, so definitely they're just a magical creature.
Yeah, they just are. Just that evil bird that kills children. Yeah, that's an evil... that's a magical creature.
We should say... they're not evil. We're just scared of them.
They are evil.
They're very important for the environment, Rhea.
Every animal's beautiful and perfect, and some of them are evil. That's fine. Crocodiles aren't evil. Cassowaries are.
Oh, we haven't even brought up crocodiles. They're like
a dinosaur. When I was talking about I want a cool shark, I got distracted because you immediately went into Megalodon. But I was saying maybe a giant crocodile would be more iconic.
Mm-hmm. I kind of want crocodiles to be friendly as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I really love the idea that there are a couple of megafauna crocodiles around, like big, like 30 yeah. or 50 foot crocodiles, but there's maybe only like two or three left in the country.
And they're purple.
Why are they purple?
Why not? I just like the idea of a big purple crocodile.
All right.
Nice.
I feel like I'm remembering a movie with a giant crocodile that's friendly, but I might be going crazy. I love giant crocodile. Okay. Owls. That's what I want to talk about. So sure. Owls deliver the mail in Harry Potter. What do we think about that?
Look, we do have some owls that are native to Australia.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, honestly, probably magpies are probably smarter and would probably be the yeah. more optional one, especially for the eastern coast.
Yeah, we don't have a lot of owls around here. I don't know if there was a lot of owls in Britain, but she decided to go for it. I definitely think a magpie is a far more intelligent bird
yeah.
and a better choice.
And they more aggressive. Are also they'll protect the male.
Very aggressive, so hard to get the male from them. They're known for, once again, swooping people and taking out the eyes of children. Why has this happened? There's like a thing where in swooping season, which is when the magpies are nesting and they will swoop you if you go near their nests.
Yeah.
It's like a common thing to wear a hat with big googly eyes on the back because yeah. they attack you from behind.
Yeah.
So if you've got eyes all over your head, they don't swoop you. But sometimes they still do swoop you, so you got to be careful.
Yeah, I've seen it happen at least six times in the last week. Someone being swooped while I'm sitting in my car.
Yeah, in the last week.
Yeah, literally, it's swooping season here.
Yeah. So it would not be unusual to see magpies flying around all the place swooping things. And they're also known for stealing shit.
Mm-hmm.
Because they do that, they do the crow thing where they take cool, shiny stuff.
Yeah.
So seeing a magpie flying around with a letter during the day is like, oh yeah.
Whatever.
It stole it, I guess.
I also think we wouldn't be showy. We wouldn't have big parchment letters because remember we got paper bark. I imagine we have yeah. little tiny scrolls that are just attached to their
feet. That's what I'm thinking.
Like it rolls up like paper bark does when you leave it out in the sun. Mm-hmm. And like, you know, much more subtle.
Yeah, I think small, thin scrolls that you can attach to birds' legs, and then if you need to, you can expand them with magic.
Yeah, yeah, easy.
Yeah, so that's what I think is our male bird. We'll probably get more into that when we talk about culture.
I also like to think, just this is my thing, I like to think that also they're not really, like, domesticated. Like, no one owns a magpie and uses it to send letters. I think you just go out and you have to attract one. You just have to summon one.
I like that as well. They're not trained. They're just... Okay, so we know there's a magical chain of being, and owls are, like, the most intelligent, and they know the secret language of names, and they can understand us and stuff. I like the idea that magpies in Australia are very, very intelligent, and, like, you can bargain with them.
Yeah.
Like, I'll give you this sick button if you take this letter to my nan.
Yeah.
Yeah, that sort of thing. Like, you've got to strike a deal.
Literally,
yeah. They've got their own bird economy.
Yeah, and so that's why I think sending letters to each other is not as common as it is in Britain, because you kind of have to bargain with a bird to do it.
Yeah.
I really like that.
Strike a deal with this bird. I'm getting swindled by the magpies.
$69 dues for one letter. Also, our magical currency is dollar dues. Let's be real.
Yeah, of course it's not. Although, is there a better name than nuts?
Oh, God. Do we have more on fauna animals?
That's everything that I've got on fauna. I feel like I could just sit here and come up yeah. with dumb, stupid magic animals forever. I feel like we've already been talking about this for about half an hour. We should move on.
Please send us the fan art. We'll continue. Okay. I would like to finish up with a few points here. How has the land been shaped pre and post colonization? So mm-hmm. just some things to consider. The colonial fear of the Australian landscape and nature. Where is magic now in a colonized land? Physically, where is it? The majority of the population lives coastally and the central Australia is quite empty in terms of population. Mm-hmm. So my theory here basically is that when I say colonial fear of Australian landscape and nature, that is a big part mm-hmm. of the history and the culture of this country. Yeah. From a colonial perspective, is that basically when this land was settled by colonizing Europeans, they came to this, what they viewed as a sparse, desolate wasteland, mm-hmm. an untamable mm-hmm. environment that would kill them. That there was no green, there was no lushness, there was mm-hmm. no life, and they were terrified of it. And then they encountered a First Nations people who were completely accustomed to the land, knew how to manage it, and thrived, mm-hmm. and that created this awful fear and paranoia that contributed to a lot of the racism and violence that exists in our history.
Yeah. Very much Australia is like a harsh, empty land full of terrible spiders that will kill you in ways you can't even imagine. Something that often occurs to me, well, every single time I get the opportunity to travel overseas, which has happened many times because I've lived a very privileged, fortunate life. I've often gotten the chance to travel.
Mm-hmm.
Every time I get off a plane in another country, my first thought upon looking around is, first of all, usually, fuck, it's cold here. And then followed up immediately by everything green. Is so green.
Yeah, it's green.
It's so green.
Yeah.
Without being here and looking at this country, you cannot appreciate how fucking brown and dead everything looks here.
But, like, I love it.
Oh, yeah, of course. I love a burnt, sunburnt country, babe.
You know, absolutely.
I talked about the east coast of Australia as a rainforest, and it is, technically, and literally. But also, like, just driving through the farmlands, the fields, like, the places around cities and in between buildings, everything here is so brown and such a, like, a dulled green compared to plants in other countries that it doesn't actually, like, when you go to other countries, like I said, everything is a vivid, vivid, bright green.
It looks photoshopped over there. It doesn't look real.
Yeah, it doesn't look real. Other countries look insane. Everything's so bright and lush.
It's like Candyland, you know?
Yeah, it looks like a magical fantasy land, just like, I don't know, England.
It's disgusting.
And then here, like, I love the way our country looks. It's beautiful, it's gorgeous to me, but it does look, like, to the eyes of an outsider, it looks dead. Yeah. And so when colonizers first came over here, and you got to think as well, a lot of them were brought here against their will. They were brought to this dead, seemingly empty land full of all sorts of insane creatures they couldn't wrap their brains around. Yeah, like, a lot of them felt like they'd been shipped literally to hell.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which definitely had a impact on the consciousness of time.
Jeez.
The collective consciousness.
Yeah. So, yeah, that's the colonial fear. Where is the magic now in a colonized land? I personally think we've talked about how the land is palpably magic.
Mm.
I think with the effects of colonization of the last 250 years or so, definitely the magic has been pushed just as the colonial border has expanded. So obviously, like, when you walk around this country, you'd still feel the magic, you'd still be able to see it, but I think obviously it would be more vivid in the outback and in the more untouched parts of the country is where it would be more palpable.
Yeah, I think that's true. I don't really have anything more to comment there. I think you've said it.
It's just like we were saying earlier in this episode, where it's like, there's a noticeable difference. The vibes change when you drive further inland. Like, obviously, like, we still have a beautiful country in it. It's a very different experience living on the East Coast. But the further inland you drive, the more surreal things start to feel.
That's true.
And I think that's definitely the essence of what I'm getting at here with Magical Australia, is that the East Coast is, like, fairly sort of normalized, like, you know, there is magic there, but it's more hidden pockets of magic, similar to what we see in the Harry Potter books. But the further inland you get, the harder it is to not notice the magic.
Yeah, the lines blur.
The lines blur significantly.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I think that will become more apparent as we talk about history and culture as well.
The red center, the magical center, it all fits.
Spiders flee before it. No, this is Australia. Spiders flee towards it. It all fits.
I think there's also something to be said about how the magnetic centre of Australia is Uluru as well.
Ooh, yeah.
Like, that feels very magical.
I didn't think of that as well. Yeah, Uluru's magnetic.
Yeah, if we're saying that, like, a lot of the magical presence and the palpability of magic is in Central Australia, in the outback, in the bush, Uluru is the centre of Australia. Like, it would be the most magical place.
Yeah, it's almost exactly in the centre. It's not quite, because it's a bit further north.
Yeah.
But yeah, almost, if you picked up a map of Australia and put your finger right in the centre of it, that would be where Uluru is.
Basically where Alice Springs and Uluru is.
Yeah, it is a deeply, deeply magical place. It's gotta be. There is a fucking huge rock in the centre of our country. It's a magnet. You can't touch it, or you shouldn't touch it, because it shouldn't be touched, but people climb it. It's terrible.
It has, you can't climb it anymore. Yeah, it's illegal to climb it, thankfully.
Good.
It's a sacred site. It has waterfalls. It's beautiful. I've actually seen pictures of the waterfalls before. It's just, it would be amazing to see it in person. I'd love to go see
Uluru in person. Yeah, that's got to be the most magical site in Australia.
That's, I mean, that's just sort of the tip of the iceberg of what I imagine Australian magical land is like. And again, I'd like to reiterate that we're both white mm-hmm. Australians, and our perspectives are limited and would be so much more enriched with the point of views and perspectives of First Nations peoples. Mm-hmm. So that's Australian magical land. I don't know how we end this.
It's Australian magical land. Next time we're going to try and cover Australian magical history, a topic that would be difficult to cover in one episode without the word magic in there.
Yeah.
That's going to be hectic.
I've been Jem, and see you later, alligators.
And I've been Rhea, in a while, crocodile.
Thanks for listening. If you want to support us or get in touch, the links to our social media and Patreon are in the show notes. Please feel free to send us so many messages that we go mad and run away to a hut on a rock in the middle of the sea just to avoid them. You'll hear from us again in 2 weeks' time.
In terms of Australia... Oh, sorry. Can we hear someone screaming for attention in the background?
Hear it. Yeah, that's
awful. Hey, shut up.
We're busy.
Shh, quiet.
She's never done that before. 6 years.
Sorry. Completely. She literally just ran up and started meowing for attention. Shush.
So in terms of Australia?
Yeah, what the fuck was I talking about?
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.